May it please the court, my name is Julie Porto, and I represent the defendant, the appellant, Mr. Cecil Truman. With respect to the first assignment of error, the question before the court is, can a prosecutor establish the necessary good cause to support a null pros motion by speculating that it might obtain a conviction in a trial where defense counsel might be ineffective, and as a result, the defendant might file a habeas action, and that habeas action might be successful?
My question on that is, do we even have jurisdiction? Once a null pros is granted in the previous case, it's as if it never the case never happened. We're a court of limited jurisdiction. I don't see that it's a final criminal ruling that we even have jurisdiction on.
Yes, I understand that. But this court's decision in Moore gives authority to review a situation like this. Moore says that there are statutory or constitutional consequences from the re-indictment of a null pros, and quote, those consequences are reviewable, end quote. One of the examples it gives is a Sixth Amendment violation of a speedy trial. Of course, here we're talking about Virginia constitutional
But I think Judge Huff's question goes to, it's true we can review the consequence. I don't think there's any question about that. So there's been a re-indictment here, and we can, and that case went to trial, and it's certainly reviewable by us. I think Judge Huff's question goes to the collateral effects of the original null pros, where that's clearly not reviewable. Now, if you're going to argue some kind of a, I don't know, double jeopardy or speedy trial kind of issue that relates back to that, that's all well and good. But all we can notice is the fact of the null pros and not the underlying basis for it, because that is not directly reviewable.
Well, I think if you the statute that gives the court authority is 17.1406. It says the court can review any final conviction in a circuit court. In this case, if the court were to decide that null pros order was entered incorrectly, it's as if it never happened. And it's therefore that conviction is simply a continuation of the original indictments. And in that case, the court is reviewing a conviction.
Okay, you lost me. When you null pros a charge, the indictment is a nullity.
Correct, Your Honor.
And if you want to bring the charge back, you certainly can, assuming jeopardy is not attached. And what you have to do, though, is go back to a grand jury and get a new indictment. And that is the one, that is the charging document that goes forward. Am I missing something?
I hate to phrase it this way, Your Honor, but...
Yes,
I am. I did that for like 47 years, and apparently I've been doing it all wrong all that time.
If the null pros order was incorrect, that null pros order is a nullity, and so the concern that former indictment is a nullity is no longer true.
But it's the re-indictment that is reviewable under Moore as opposed to the original null pros indictment, isn't it?
I don't think that's what Moore says. Moore says, as Judge Humphreys pointed out, that you can review the consequences. The consequences in this case is a violation of Mr. Truman's speedy trial constitutional rights. And so if the court looks and says, yes, those are the consequences of allowing this re-indictment, the court then has the authority to reverse the convictions that resulted from that re-indictment.
Let me put it a different way here, because I don't think we can get, unless we can get past this point where there's no point even talking about the merits. And now you've managed to thoroughly confuse me, so let me see if I can get straightened out here. So hypothetically, if the Commonwealth indicts an individual and, the speedy trial clock starts running from the moment of, a direct indictment, and then before the clock runs out, let's say four months, he's in custody, 4 months and 29 days, later, one day shy of the speedy trial clock expiring, the Commonwealth null processes the charge. That becomes a nullity, it seems to me, under our current jurisprudence. If the Commonwealth then re-indicts, the clock starts all over again, and we don't add 4 months and 29 days on, because that's for all legal purposes, a brand new charge, correct? Am I missing something there?
No, that's right, Your Honor. But if you go back to the premise that the entry of the null pros made the original indictment a nullity, if the entry of the null pros was incorrect, then that indictment should have never become a nullity. It should have continued. And I think Moore addresses that because Moore does look at a situation, Moore does look back, excuse me, at the entry of a null pros in a prior case. It does look at that. It does review that. Now, ultimately, Moore decides that there's good cause. But the court does believe it has jurisdiction to review that initial nullity, or excuse me, review that initial, the order from that initial case. And so it implicitly finds that it has authority to do that. The other thing I would say is that a trial court order has to be reviewable. And we know based on the court's decision in Duggins.
I'm not sure it does, but I mean, it seems to me, and Judge O'Brien and I were having an informal discussion about this not long ago, but we have the separation of powers concept here that we sometimes pay actual lip service to, and the determination of a charge is usually exclusively that of the executive branch of government. Now, we have a statute that requires that a null pros be approved by the court for good cause shown. But I've often wondered how effective that actually is, given that I don't see a way for a court to force a Commonwealth attorney who assesses a charge as being insufficient to force them to go to trial if they elect not to. So assuming the Commonwealth attorney represents as an officer of the court that there's a reason, whether it be, you know, concern for the defendant's ability to get a fair trial, which frankly I think is an appropriate consideration for a prosecutor. They're held to a higher standard, and I think that is entirely within their ambit to decide. But that gets to the merits of what we're talking about here, I guess. But in the abstract, it seems to me if a court finds good cause and grants the motion, even if we determined that later on, if we could review it, that the so-called good cause was insufficient, I don't see how we or any other court could force a prosecutor to go forward with a charge that he or she did not believe was appropriate for whatever reason.
I understand that, Judge Humphreys, and that's why the initial null pros can't be reviewed or changed because it makes no sense. What is the remedy? There is no remedy. So we know you can review that initial entry of a null pros because it's been done. The only way to do that is after a conviction, and the only way you're going to get a conviction is if you re-indict those charges. So following that logic, knowing that we can review the initial entry of the null pros, it only makes sense that that review occurs after the re-indictment and after a conviction from that re-indictment. And that's what that was the basis of the court's decision in Duggins, where, like Moore, the court in Duggins said, there are certain circumstances that we can review consequences, and in this case, and it always has to, if this court can review consequences of a null pros entry in a prior prosecution, it always has to look back at the prior prosecution in deciding whether or not good cause existed.
Well, hypothetically, it seems to me, I can think of at least two cases off the top of my head, two situations where your point would be well taken. One would be where a null pros occurred mid-trial and jeopardy had attached. If the prosecution then re-indicted, clearly there would be a valid double jeopardy claim that we could address, and we would be able to look back and determine if jeopardy had in fact attached at that earlier null pros. So that would be a situation where we would look at the consequences and then apply them forward to the new indictment, if you will. A similar situation seems to me would be if the speedy trial clock had actually expired prior to the null pros. You know, we'd have a statutory bar, not a constitutional bar, but a statutory bar to re-indictment because the Commonwealth didn't honor its obligation to get the defendant to trial within the requisite amount of time. But I can't think of any other circumstances off the top of my head that would permit us to do that. In both those cases, we're simply looking back at the consequences, not at the at the underlying basis for the null pros. We don't care why it was null pros. We only care when it was null pros in both those situations, don't we?
In one sense, Your Honor. First of all, if there is a violation of speedy trial deadlines before the null pros, then really it's not the null pros that's being reviewed.
Right.
You're saying that that occurred before the case became a nullity, and that's why you can review that. But there are also situations, and the situation in Moore and Duggins was that the speedy trial clock did, or excuse me, I'm sorry, in Moore, the speedy trial clock didn't run until after the null pros was entered. And so because the court has done it before, unless the court en banc decides to reverse its decision that it can hear these cases because it has heard these cases, then I think Moore stands for the proposition that we have to get to the merits. I don't think Moore or Duggins delineates whether that violation occurs before the null pros or after. And I don't think it makes sense that it can only be before the null
pros. But you're asking us here to address whether good cause was demonstrated at a null pros at an earlier, and I guess that gets it's circular, but it gets back to Judge Huss's original question, which is why do we care? How could we possibly review that? And even if we said the court shouldn't have done it, it's done, and therefore it's not really reviewable by us.
I go back to Moore, Your Honor. If you read Moore, it specifically says speedy trial consequences. And is there
an allegation that the null pros occurred after the clock had expired in that case?
No, Your Honor. But this is why the speedy trial implications have to occur after that null pros. Because if you're talking about speedy trial implications before
the trial ended with the null pros, how could there be a speedy trial problem until the clock gets restarted by a new indictment?
Because if the consequences, or if the, actually, can you repeat that question,
yeah.
Judge Humphreys? I'm not sure I understand.
The null pros terminated the case. That case went away. It disappeared. It's a nullity. The Commonwealth seeks a new indictment. Assuming the speedy trial clock had not already expired, which would be a statutory bar to further prosecution, assuming that's not the case and you're conceding that's not the case, then all we care about is the process that began with the indictment, the new indictment, and whether, you know, that was proper or not, don't we? I mean,
that's right. But if we determine that it was improper, then that indictment continues.
But that's a collateral attack on a different case.
If it were a trial court looking at this collaterally, that would be a problem.
How is it any less collateral for us to look at? It's a different case.
Rule 1:1 says the trial court can't do it. Rule 1:1 doesn't affect this court's jurisdiction to do it.
And we don't review cases that are not before us.
That's,
and that case is not and cannot be before us. Only the consequences of it could be.
The consequences of an improper null pros being entered in this case was the was a violation of the speedy trial deadlines. If the only way that we could review consequences of speedy trial deadlines were if they occurred before the null pros, we're no longer looking at that null pros. We're looking at that deadline because it's at that point that they're no longer, that the court, or excuse me, that the prosecutor no longer has ability to reindict. That reindictment is not a problem because the null pros was entered incorrectly. It was a problem because the prosecution wasn't begun within that deadline. The null pros in that case, where the speedy trial runs beforehand, really has no bearing on the court's decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Basically, the court's correct that the null pros decision cannot be reviewed because, of course, it's not in this case. What complicates the matter is that there was a motion filed on September 3rd, I believe it is, that asked the judge in the second set of cases to review what had happened. So I think it's a little different from your ordinary lack of jurisdiction case, because the court did have that issue before it, but it did review, it did rule, as it should, that no, the Now Pross ended that case. It has nothing to do with this. There's no delay after that, so there's no speedy trial problem. But basically, as the court's already indicated, there is absolutely nothing wrong with the judge's decision in this case to allow the Now Pross. The court generally defers to the Commonwealth unless there is manifest as contrary to manifest public interest. Clearly, that's not true here. As the court has already pointed out, the Commonwealth Attorney is required to try to assure a fair trial to the defendant. That's exactly what happened here. The defense counsel said, I cannot be ready. This is like 3 days. And he said, well, I haven't looked at the discovery. The defendant made a statement. I may want to suppress that. He did, in fact, move to suppress it when the re-indictment occurred. And I haven't talked to the witnesses. And this is, obviously, a multi-count case, very serious crimes. And the Commonwealth Attorney says, Judge, I want to protect my convictions. And the judge clearly, well, even if you were to get to the merits, I don't think there'd be any question that the judge acted properly. Second issue has not been addressed. I don't know if the court has any questions about the second issue. But
well, Judge Huff raised the jurisdictional issue, and I assume you agree that we don't have jurisdiction to, in any way, shape, or form, review the at least directly, other than the possible consequences, but the underlying reason for the null process in the original case.
Yes, Your Honor. Basically, you cannot address that. And so the only difference is that usually what you get is an attack on the ruling at the now pro stage. Here, the defendant did try to revive the question by raising it in the second set of proceedings.
But the assignment of error reads, the trial court erroneously found good cause to grant the Commonwealth's motion to null pros Mr. Truman's charges. I mean, that's a reference to the first.
Yes, Your Honor. The page reference as to where it was raised is at page 35.
Yes, sir.
And if that were all that were in the case, there'd be no question about that. But the only slight difference is that there is, in fact, a raising of that issue later on, which the defendant has not relied upon, apparently. Okay. If the court wants me to address the second issue, then.
It's up to you.
thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Rebuttal? Portal?
Although there's been indications, I don't know what the court's decision is going to be with respect to jurisdiction, so I would like to briefly address the merits of the case. In cases where we're reviewing a motion, the court has decided that where the prosecution has identified shortcomings in its own case, the court has upheld granting of a null pros.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Berger versus United States.
I'm sorry, which you...
Berger versus United States. It's the mantra, I will tell you, it's the mantra for prosecutors, because what Berger says is the prosecutor, and I'm paraphrasing, the prosecutor's job is not to seek a conviction, it is to seek justice. And as a result, prosecutors are held to a higher standard than other lawyers are. And prosecutors get disciplined routinely when they violate that standard. So it seems to me that it's valid for a prosecutor to be concerned if the defendant he's prosecuting in his or her judgment is not going to receive a fair trial because of perceived deficiencies on the part of defense counsel. And I will tell you, from my own personal experience as a prosecutor, many's the time I had to clue defense counsel in serious cases of, you know, making a record and certain things to avoid a potential habeas down the road. I think that's, personally, I think that's perfectly appropriate. And if necessary, I think, you know, I don't see a problem with a prosecutor who is legitimately concerned about a defendant receiving a fair trial, if necessary, null pressing the charge and then taking whatever steps later to bring it back at a point in time when they believe that they will get a fair trial. What's wrong with that analysis?
May I?
Thank you,
Your Honor. Number one, Mr. Truman didn't need anyone to protect his constitutional rights in this case. He had counsel who was doing so. He had the judge, which was reviewing what trial counsel thought was appropriate to protect those rights, and the trial judge made its decision. Secondly, the cases that the Commonwealth cites really stretches those holdings beyond what they're meant to do. They're talking about a fair prosecution in the context of what a prosecutor can control, managing his own conduct. Those cases do not talk about a prosecutor trying to control a defendant's or defense counsel's actions. And the reason for that is because the prosecutor doesn't have all the information necessary to make that determination. There can be a motion that the prosecutor thinks is a horrible motion, but that's because he doesn't have information that the defendant and defendant's counsel has. Finally, the proper remedy, if that were a concern, is not a null pros motion. It is a motion under McNair, and the reason for that is under McNair, before a defendant is stripped of constitutional rights, he has an opportunity, number one, to correct his behavior. Number two, the standard for removing that constitutional right is far more stringent than a null pros, and it does not include deference to the prosecutor. And number three, there is a very detailed analysis that this court has put forward that a court must go through to make a final decision that we're going to strip this individual of his constitutional rights. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the Scalzot case.